Hi, friends. Welcome to True Crime with Yvonne Estelle. I'm your host. And I have got to say, I went into today's episode, first of all, with like a busted knee. I went to sit down and I bumped my knee so hard into the table. Like, that was agonizing. Oh, God. Just because there's sometimes how lonely it could be when you record alone. Cause it's like there was no one in here to see it, which is like not embarrassing. But then also, I don't know, no one to laugh about that with. So that's crazy. But also, I went into today's episode with a completely different case planned. See, originally, I was going to go cover the case of Christine Paolila. Her story was one of the first cases that got me into true crime as a kid. But then, as I started researching her, I actually couldn't find the documentary that I originally watched. So I'm sitting there preparing to go through my research, go through like different articles, and that's when I found another case by happenstance. And it was just too unbelievable not to cover. Honestly, this season is all about betrayal, and there is no worse betrayal than someone innocent being hurt at the result of a love affair. This is going to pull on your heartstrings a bit, and not in the way that you think. This is the story of Tony Abad. And before I get started, Tony's last name was pronounced Abad. And so I'm going to go by Abad because that's kind of what I heard from friends and family the most. And then that just kind of seems like based on spelling. So yeah, I just wanted to let everyone know that going forward. Okay. So our story begins in a suburb outside of Atlanta called Fairburn. I feel like when people think of Atlanta, they think of this booming metropolitan area. It is often referred to as Black Hollywood. And a lot of people flock to moving down there for job opportunities, good food, fun, and cheaper living. Although I have heard that now the city has become a bit oversaturated, and the result being the price of living going up. The city of Fairburn, though, is adorable. It is 20 minutes outside of the city and from that major airport, and the area is always having events. Like this year, they have a Fairburn Fall Festival and a breast cancer awareness walk, as well as like a harvest festival. The population is small, though, with about 17,000 people, and the majority being people of color. It is known to be a working class area. It is known for being quiet, and it's known for being close-knit. It was where Tony Abad lived. A woman who was known for her southern charm and kind blue eyes. She was really loving and fiercely stood up for her family. She had a few sisters who she was incredibly close with. They often described her laugh as electric. Tony was one of those people who lived quite a life and deserves just experience peace. She was a divorcee and a mom of four boys and five grandkids. She became a mother to her first son, Michael, at 15 years old, but eventually married a man named Timothy years later, and the two of them had three boys together. Tony was able to really blend the family, but upon her divorce to her husband, she was entering a new phase of being a grandma. She loved her grandkids so much, they could do no wrong in her eyes, and Tony worked in the daytime as a deli manager for a popular Fairburn grocery store. She was known to be like the mom of the store too. Tony was just fulfilled. The morning of December 22nd, 2017, things should have been normal in Fairburn. I would imagine they were getting ready for some holiday event and that neighbors could expect to just enjoy the new year coming in. The weather during that time was cold, but I don't imagine it was like New Jersey, New York cold. And most people were just excited to be spending time with loved ones. But local police were in for a rude awakening when they received a call about a suspicious 2012 Ford Fusion vehicle parked behind a Waffle House. Now, let me pause. I have to admit something. I have never had Waffle House. And so many people talk about the food being good and like all the fights that happen there. I just never have experienced it. Anyway, once the officers arrived at the scene, they noticed the driver's side window to the car was busted out. Now, it could have been a Waffle House manager or a customer calling concerned, but upon the busted window, police weren't sure what to make of it. Like, it could have been a robbery, which means someone was going to be missing items, but the car, upon more investigation, kind of seemed more so abandoned. It wasn't like the alarm was going off or anything. What was even more concerning was the car keys. They were laying on the driver's seat side. The officers ran the tags of the car. Maybe it was stolen. But they quickly learned the vehicle was registered to a woman named Toni Abbott. And Toni wasn't in the Waffle House. The police called her home and the calls just went straight to voicemail. There were shards of glass everywhere inside the car, and there was a bit of blood near the driver's side too. Still, it sounded like a strange carjacking or robbery. But it wasn't until officers opened the trunk that they found something much more sinister. A body. A woman's body, to be exact. This was officially a homicide, not a robbery. The woman had injuries to her head and to her face. It was clear that she was beaten to death. In fact, she was beaten so badly, police couldn't identify her. But she did have something that gave an indication of who she was. A name tag from a grocery store. And that name was Toni Abbott. Police were also able to use a fingerprint scanner, which I did not realize was a thing. It is a way to identify people, and it's how they identified Toni. Now, I don't know if this scanner had her prints just because of her work history or if she had had trouble with the law from years ago. I didn't find any evidence of that. But her prints were in the system, and they were able to identify her. At this point, though, how long had Toni been missing? The mother and grandmother was expected to be preparing for the holiday season herself. She had an annual Christmas dinner that had happened, and at this point, that was only about 3 days away. It wasn't like Toni to just disappear. Between work and her kids and her grandchildren, Toni had a lot of people that depended on her. Police picked up their first real clue on the crime scene. See, remember how I said that there was glass everywhere and on the inside of the car door? That would be consistent with maybe a carjacking or robbery. But there wasn't any glass on the outside, which means whatever happened to Toni had to have happened somewhere else. And maybe Toni being in the trunk wasn't where she was actually attacked. Medical examiners were able to determine that Toni was killed by blunt force trauma to the head. Detectives were having an issue of figuring out why. Like, her keys and her wallet were still in the car, but her phone was gone. Again, another sign of this not being a robbery. Detectives called Toni's family to break the news, and her son, Michael, was in disbelief. In fact, there were reports that said that he had tried to go and see, like, you know, maybe let me identify her because maybe you'll have it wrong. But it was that scanner that was able to allow police to say, no, this is Toni Abbott. The next question is, who could possibly do this? The intensity of the injuries had police feeling like this attack was personal. But Toni's family don't have a clue of who would want to hurt their mom. Toni was single, so there wasn't any boyfriend with a vendetta. She was a good manager, and she stuck with her family. So the question was, who? Who could have done this? Police began to try to track Toni's phone, and it was located on Church Street off Highway 92, which ended up being about 5 miles from the crime scene itself. It was one of those eerie dead-end type of places, just an abandoned area. But it didn't take long for police to locate Toni's phone on the side of the road. And next to her phone was droplets and puddles of blood, broken pieces of glass, and both the blood and glass matched Toni's phone and car. Police went to the grocery store where Toni worked. It was the last place Toni was seen alive. On the 21st, she'd gone on her shift and left after clocking out of work. Coworkers basically reiterated the same thing, that things seemed fine and that everyone loves Toni. Except for one of her coworkers, who explained that after closing the store, they were approached by a stranger. A woman in a black jacket with a fur hood on it. The woman apparently asked Tony for a ride home, which Tony, being kind, obliged. The woman apparently looked like a young girl. Tony didn't seem like she knew this woman per se, but apparently, according to Tony's coworker, Tony felt like she needed to help this young lady because it was a colder evening and it seemed like the girl really needed help. Police knew that there was someone else that saw Tony before she died, and they needed to identify who that was. As police go through the footage of that night from the grocery store, they pick up on something. And it's really eerie. So you see a slender woman in like this big puffy jacket with headphones, and she's pacing back and forth outside of the grocery store. And then you see Tony and her coworker, just the two of them, walking outside and into the parking lot. And here's where things get creepy. The young girl like instinctively follows. Now you could say she was waiting to see who she could ask for a ride. But what if it was something else? Moreover, the girl is on camera, but literally the footage is so grainy that you cannot tell who the young lady is. Even with the freeze frame, it's difficult, I should actually say. Police tried canvassing the shopping center if anyone had seen the girl in the blurry photo. And that's when a manager at a nearby Sonic was able to confirm that they did recognize that girl. In fact, she was there all the time. The manager says that she comes around and will just kind of like sit and loiter a bit. Now, this just goes to show that actually putting up pictures in an area where a crime has happened or someone has gone missing does help. It can make a difference. Because the manager of this restaurant explained that this woman did hang around and they were trying to get her to like leave. In fact, they'd even tried to get the police involved, and on the last day they saw her hanging around, she'd actually left all of her belongings near the restaurant, which was strange. In fact, employees at the restaurant assumed that she was eventually likely to come back for them. I mean, it was like a big bag of clothes and makeup. But she never came back for them, which means police were able to go through the bag. And in a major lucky break, they found an ID for a woman who kind of fit the imagery of that grainy photo. And her name was De'Asia Page. Police had a lead. De'Asia Page was a recent high school dropout. She was 18 years old and was looking for her independence. She wasn't getting along with her mother and had recently moved out of the house as well. De'Asia wasn't always this way, though. She grew up shy and sweet. She hung out with her girlfriends and enjoyed having like TV and movie nights and just being a teenage girl. She was known for being super nice. She had this long, slender build and these large eyes, and she had like a teeth full of braces. I cannot explain enough how much of a young kid De'Asia seemed to be, which to be honest, wasn't what I was expecting when I started this case. And I don't think it was what the police were expecting either. Most importantly, though, it was De'Asia's mom who was shocked by De'Asia's personality shift. She claimed that it began when De'Asia started dating 18-year-old Jared Kemp. Jared also grew up in the Fairburn area. He came from a good family. He went to military school and was planning to go into the Coast Guard. The two, if anything, were like young lovers who could have been considered high school sweethearts. In an alternate world, you'd almost imagine them dating through high school and even into college. I mean, they had a whirlwind relationship, but De'Asia's family and friends noticed a difference. The couple were glued at the hip, and that soft image Jared had was starting to crack. Jared had begun hanging out with a rougher crew in high school, and it was unlike how he first appeared. Jared was, like, kind of tall, had a short little fro, and these like blaring bright eyes. In just passing pictures, you would also kind of think he was just a young kid. But where Jared was going was a lot more dangerous than anyone could have expected. See, he started getting into more trouble. And also, as it turns out, he had a really bad temper, and it was starting to show in his relationship. He would call De'Asia a bitch and a hoe. He would talk down to her constantly. But De'Asia, instead of leaving, began to become more isolated. She'd stuck with Jared and pulled away from her family and friends, who basically were saying that this guy is not good news. I want to pause for a minute and make it clear that these are telltale signs of an abusive relationship. Being emotionally or mentally manipulated, being spoken to disturbingly, and then being pulled away from your friends and family so that no one really knows what's going on. This wasn't puppy love. This was a dangerous relationship unfolding. And even though Jared may have looked like a kid and just whatever, it doesn't mean that his behavior was okay or a phase or anything other than a sign of something really dark on its way. And the results were that everyone around De'Asia slowly was being pushed away. Her mother had tried to intervene, giving De'Asia basically an ultimatum. Either you leave Jared and focus on school and yourself, or you stay with him, but you can't stay here in this house. And De'Asia left her mom's house and withdrew from school, which at 18 she legally could do. I remember being 13 and me and my mom being at odds. And if anything, I'm glad that I was younger so that I couldn't go anywhere, because eventually, like, I stayed and obviously finished school and the rest is really good history. But I'm also really glad that my mom and I, like, stuck it out and we kind of made it through our growing pains. I'm sure mother-daughter relationships are different for everybody, and I love my mom. She's, like, the best ever, and she did a really good job raising me. But I can only imagine what De'Asia's mom was going through, because it's like they didn't really have any issues until De'Asia starts dating this guy. And then by that time, De'Asia is a young adult and has the autonomy and the ability to just leave. De'Asia's friends at this point and school counselor all claim that De'Asia just seemed lost. Like, when they would talk to her, her eyes were empty. Police interviewed everyone close to De'Asia but couldn't find her. I mean, she wasn't at her mom's house or at school or with her friends, so where was she? And what did she know about Tony Abad? It didn't take long for police to locate De'Asia after blasting her photo basically all over Atlanta. They made it clear that she had a connection with Tony's murder. And I mean, De'Asia's photo was everywhere, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, the news, which I can only imagine at 18 what you would do. Eventually, though, a security guard at a local Texaco gas station came to police explaining that they saw De'Asia hanging around with a blanket to keep her warm. The security guard, who remains anonymous, as a lot of people are going to be in this case, explained that he let her stay in his car to warm up during hours of his shift. De'Asia told him that she was homeless. Now, this actually had been occurring in the days leading up to the 21st, and De'Asia was kind of known to hang around at this particular gas station. To be clear, I don't know if anything physical or sexual was happening with the security guards or anyone really that De'Asia came in contact with when hanging out at this gas station. So I can't tell you if she was there just to have somewhere to be or if she was trying to find other means of survival. But on the 21st, things were different. De'Asia showed up to the gas station and she was like frantic, panicking. She said that someone needed help, that she had witnessed a murder down the street. Now, at this point, the security guards chalked it up to maybe De'Asia being on, like, drugs or as another way to get and ask for something. According to them, they looked away and let her just kind of do her thing, basically hanging on the gas station. So at this point, they didn't really pay her much mind. And when she's like, I witnessed a murder, it isn't until the next morning they realize, oh my gosh, she may have been telling the truth. Now, why they don't immediately come to the police is beyond me. I'm speculating it could have been something about their relationship with De'Asia. I don't know. It could have also been just like them minding their business or just not taking her seriously. But once De'Asia is basically going viral for being wanted, they step up and contact the police. But this meant that De'Asia was now a witness and really did know more about Tony's murder. Tips continue to pour in about De'Asia's whereabouts when De'Asia actually walks into the police station. She admits that she did accept a ride with Tony that night, and she had Tony take her to the Texaco gas station. She says that she gave Tony directions, but as they were nearing, they suddenly were blindsided. because two black men jumped out into the road and started smashing on the window. Apparently, Tony fell out of the car and one of the men ran away. So then that means if just Tony laying out of the car, this random man and De'Asia. And that's when the man just started beating Tony to death. The man then ordered De'Asia to help him put Tony in the trunk with him and then made De'Asia drive the car to the Waffle House. Okay, so let me repeat that because it sounds crazy as hell. De'Asia claims that she and Tony were in the car when two black men jumped into the street, forcing Tony to stop driving, and then they ripped the car door open and one man started attacking Tony while the other man fled. After he kills Tony, he forces De'Asia, who I guess had stayed in the car the entire time during the attack, to help him put Tony in the trunk, and then tells her to drive to the Waffle House parking lot and drop the car off. De'Asia claims that she was so scared that she basically did what she was told. Now, what's confusing is the fact that she then walks from the Waffle House to the Texaco gas station, which I guess would make sense because they were in a similar vicinity of each other. But why not try to go to the police or even go inside of the Waffle House and try to get help? Police had questions too. In fact, Detective Jackson, who was interviewing De'Asia, walked out of the interrogation room, basically giving her time to rethink her story because he didn't buy it. And that is when the station got a call from a neighboring police station saying that Jared Kemp had come into the station with a similar story. Jared, too, was proactive, but basically it was to pin everything on De'Asia. He claimed that he actually didn't even know De'Asia and that he was clearing his name in case it came up. The audacity. Detectives decide to use this, though, to their advantage. They bring up Jared's statement to De'Asia. And just like when you're a teenager, you cry over a stupid boy. Because De'Asia was heartbroken. Jared had basically said that he didn't claim or really know De'Asia and that she was nuts. And we know that from friends and family, Jared basically was the reason De'Asia was homeless at that point. But Jared had gone to the police the same day De'Asia did, coincidentally, to separate himself from her. And furthermore, to say that he had nothing to do with the murder. De'Asia at this point is literally losing it, and I wonder if she didn't realize the importance of calling her mom or getting an attorney at this point, or maybe if she had and it just wasn't in any of the sources that I could find. But she is consumed with the fact that this boy basically no longer claimed to even know her. And eventually those tears turned into anger, and thus came the truth. De'Asia explained what really happened that night. Jared had apparently tried to steal a car so that De'Asia could have somewhere to sleep. Mind you, Jared lives in a decent home, but he could not extend his place to De'Asia to stay. So the couple looked for cars to steal so that she could sleep. De'Asia didn't want to live on the street anymore, and it seemed that Jared was just coaxing De'Asia to stay out a little longer. De'Asia, who was spending her days loitering the shopping center and sleeping in cars, was getting tired of this. But Jared instructed her to find someone that night on the 21st and bring them to him. According to De'Asia, it wasn't supposed to be a murder. By the time she got in Tony's car that night, she knew a carjacking was supposed to happen. And when they turned on Church Street, De'Asia pulled out a fake airsoft pistol that was supposed to scare Tony. Tony wasn't afraid, though. In fact, she fights for her life upon seeing that gun. But as she's trying to fight for the gun that's in De'Asia's lap, Jared smashes the driver's window in. Tony apparently then climbs over to the passenger side and then out of the car, which means that De'Asia at one point must have gotten out of the car once Jared smashed the window. At this point, Jared did have a bat. That's how he was able to break the window. De'Asia then witnesses Jared go around the car and stand over Tony. Tony apparently begged for her life, saying, "Please don't do this." But at that point, it was too late. And Jared began beating Tony repeatedly until her body was lifeless. There, of course, are questions at this point. Why did Jared have a bat? If they were going to break the window, then what was the point of stealing a car? Because then the car would have just been cold due to a broken window. Like, it just didn't make logical sense. Was this stupid teenage shit, or was this something more of a thrill kill in the making? According to DeAsia, though, Jared knew that if Tony was alive, she would have called the police. So Jared killed Tony and made DeAsia put Tony in the trunk. Now, I don't know if Tony was like partially alive or a little bit conscious, but she bled out in that trunk. Jared instructed DeAsia to drive to the Waffle House, and he left on foot. In the hours after, Jared does his best to convince DeAsia to stay calm, giving that whole us against the world monologue. I can just pause here and say I hate when couples reference themselves as Bonnie and Clyde. I think it is so corny. And also, Bonnie and Clyde were serial killers. Like, there's nothing cute about that. There's nothing cute about crime. But by then, it was too late. DeAsia had already told the security guards what happened, except the security guards hadn't really believed her. And at this point, police kind of didn't believe her fully either. See, it kind of just sounded like it was all Jared. But police had a feeling that DeAsia actively participated in the violence as well. Still, police didn't understand why bludgeon this woman to death. Like I mentioned, police thought that this beating was by someone that knew Tony. Like, it seemed personal. So they were stunned when this was a random killing, which made police only come to terms with the fact that maybe this really was a planned murder. I mean, why did Jared have a bat? He was hanging with a darker crowd, and maybe he was trying to build his reputation. I guess the bat also could have been considered a way to scare the person out of the car. Like, it doesn't really make any sense. The town was shocked, honestly. Tony's family were relieved that they finally found the killers, but they were still confused. Why these two teen kids? Now, police at this point were looking for Jared, who, after giving his original statement, had seemed to, like, get out of Dodge. Police realized they couldn't go to trial with just DeAsia's statement. So, where was Jared? They searched his home, and his mother explained that Jared was missing. He'd apparently been hiding out at his cousin's house. Eventually, Jared was arrested. Like, it didn't take long. They were able to locate his cousin and where his cousin stayed and locate Jared. But from then on, he wasn't cooperative. Detectives collect Jared's cell phone and find communication. See, this cell phone clears up a lot of confusion. On the 21st, Jared and DeAsia have FaceTimes, voice messages, they talked on the phone, basically all day. In fact, the two of them were on the phone from the moment where DeAsia was in the car with Tony. And the call hangs up once Jared, DeAsia, and Tony were all together. Police also found web searches from Jared's phone on the day of the discovering of Tony's body. Searches like a dead lady in the trunk of a car. He was also checking news segments. Police were unable to collect physical evidence, though. They never were able to retrieve the bat. I don't know if they were able to retrieve, like, fingerprints from Jared. That's not really clear either. But the digital evidence and DeAsia's confession were enough to charge Jared Kemp. Prosecutors offer a plea deal to DeAsia, and she offers a full confession. In return, she's sentenced to 30 years in prison, meaning she'd be in her mid to late 40s by the time she's free. I don't know how involved her mom was during this time. I mean, she does have a plea deal, so maybe her mom stepped in at that point. DeAsia did come from a family that loved her and supported her, so I cannot imagine they turned their back on her at that point. As for Jared, he went to trial. And with the digital evidence and DeAsia's testimony, the prosecution wanted to show premeditation. Now, I do know that Jared and DeAsia are black. We are in the South. So it is really hard to say. Like, was this a premeditated thrill kill? Or was this a carjacking gone wrong? Could race have played a role in making these two people come off way more violent than they seemed? Like, it just kind of seems like a big jump, especially for DeAsia, this young girl, to go from being like a young girl in a bad relationship, homeless, to murder. She didn't have any criminal record or a past or anything like that that was really leading up to that type of violence. But prosecutors believe that because this was pre-planned, that the consideration of murder, whether a goal or a casualty, was in the minds of both Jared and De'Asia. And at this point, it was Jared who was on trial. Ultimately, Jared is found guilty of felony murder, armed robbery, aggravated assault, and hijacking a vehicle. He is sentenced to life in prison. There are blaringly obvious concerns that don't really make it to the general public, like Jared's DNA anywhere near the scene, and truly how much was De'Asia or Jared involved? Was it a 50-50 thing, or was it just one of the two? De'Asia was like 90 pounds soaking wet, and Tony's family believes that if it was just De'Asia involved, that Tony would probably still be alive today because Tony was a tough woman. In fact, we know when Tony sees the gun on De'Asia, she's like, no, I'm fighting for my life. It isn't clear what happened that night, and the most bizarre thing about this case is that these two kids, in hindsight, had so much going for them. I mean, every photo of De'Asia, she's laughing with friends or sitting with her family. She literally had a photo with her family, and it looks like a family reunion, and on their t-shirts it says family first. And there's De'Asia, front and center, smiling ear to ear. Jared also could have had dreams, I mean, at least of being a public servant. But somehow this codependent relationship turned abusive and then deadly. It resulted in the death of Tony, who in all of this was an innocent bystander. She was just trying to make it home to prepare for that week's Christmas dinner. I don't know what betrayal is worse. The betrayal of humankind, taking someone's kindness for weakness, or this couple who turned on each other, but not before taking the life of someone else. There are so many photos that I saw of like Tony with her grandkids. Her sons have spoken out about Tony, and she just was a good person. And her family is still trying to pick up the pieces. This story is just heartbreaking. Her granddaughter said in an interview, I guarantee if that girl, being De'Asia, needed a place to stay, my grandma would have just given her $100 to $200 just for a hotel for the night. That's just the kind of person she is. Thank you all for joining me this week. This was such a senseless, hurtful, violent crime. And I just hope that Tony's family have been able to slowly move forward since that tragedy. And as of now, we know that Jared and De'Asia are both incarcerated and have essentially ruined their lives forever. Now it is time for our true crime fact of the day. It is about poisoning. Cyanide smells like almonds. Well, actually, it's the other way around. Almonds smell like cyanide because there are trace amounts of the toxic chemical in them, just enough to smell it. I love almond-smelling lotions and soaps, so I better be careful. Even more so, my sister is like allergic to almonds. Let's just all stay away from almonds, shall we? Thank you so much for joining me this week. Catch me on Instagram and soon TikTok. Well, okay, maybe not that soon, but catch me on Instagram. And all my sources and photos are on YvonneEstelle.com. Please share this show with your friends and family. And please share it and give it 5 stars, please and thank you. I will see you in a couple weeks with another true crime case. Safe journey. Keep walking in the light. With love, Ivana Estelle.